From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The caravan of Central American migrants that Donald Trump railed against some weeks ago has arrived at the Mexican side of the border with the United States. Hundreds of people, including families and women traveling with children, set up camp at in Tijuana, requesting asylum. Late Monday night, a group of four children and their mothers and an 18-year-old young man were allowed into U.S. territory to begin processing their applications. The asylum seekers are fleeing violence from countries like Honduras, where a recent election resulted in the fraudulent win of a right-wing president and where violence has now been spiking. Meanwhile, Mexico is heading towards its own election on July 1st, where frontrunner Andrés Manuel López Obrador has generated hope among the country's liberal and left groups. My guest is Laura Carlson, director of the Americas program of the Center for International Policy, a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus based in Mexico City. Welcome to the program, Laura.
Thank you, Sonali.
So let's first talk about this caravan led by this group, Pueblo Sin Fronteras. We had covered it on our show before and explained to our audience how this is a caravan that has realized the safety in numbers. It's basically a group of refugees who are trying to protect themselves from the violence that Central American migrants face in Mexico as they try to make it to the United States. Is that an accurate way of putting it?
Yes, so they're getting together because there's a constant flow of refugees and migrants from the Central American countries for some of the reasons that you mentioned, the violence and the poverty principle among those reasons. And then in this case with the caravan, once a year, what they do is they get together in order to be protected as a group and in order to make a statement along the way. Because the dangers are not just in their home countries where they're fleeing, but there's a huge amount of danger within Mexico itself in transiting from the southern border to the northern border. So by getting together, they're able to go from place to place and make a statement, as well as having a little bit more protection and being able to negotiate better with the government, Mexican government, to try to prevent some of the things that typically happen to Central American migrants along this route, which include extortion, rape, beatings, and even assassinations by organized crime and also by members of the security forces.
So this particular caravan, I understand people were very clear that their intention wasn't to slip across the border into the United States, that they were coming to present their asylum applications as per international law and the U.S.'s own laws around asylum seekers and refugees, right?
That's right, Sonali. So this is the objective that they've had since they left from the southern border. And a lot of people joined the caravan, especially in that southern leg, in order to present their own asylum cases with the benefit of having the attention and, again, the representation of being part of the caravan. In fact, it grew much larger than many people anticipated. And that's when it got onto Donald Trump's radar and we began to see this caravan, which is a yearly event, and there are other caravans like it, and there's certainly a constant flow, as I mentioned, of refugees and migrants, but we began to see it catapulted into national and international media at that point, following the tweets by Donald Trump.
Right.
The asylum laws are very clear that they have a right to do this. Anyone has a right to do this, to present a case saying that I am fleeing imminent danger and need to be granted asylum in order to preserve my life, basically. So these are cases that are heard in the United States on a case-by-case basis. There's no asylum for a caravan. We're talking about individuals, each of whom has a reason and a history that would justify making an asylum case under national and international laws in the United States.
Now, what has the reaction by the Mexican government been to this caravan? In a way, Trump's tweets and his raising the profile of this caravan put the Mexican government on the spot too, didn't it?
Yes, it certainly did, and it's caused additional strain in what is already a very deteriorated binational relationship between the United States and Mexico, and also some strain between Mexico and its southern neighbors from what's called the Northern Triangle, which are the three countries that send the highest number of migrants and refugees through Mexico and many on to the United States, which is Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. With the Mexican government responded first by giving them some safe passage in the early stages. And now the big problem is that Donald Trump's government is saying we will not allow them in to process them, which is the normal procedure to be able to identify who has a strong asylum case. And hold the hearings that should take place in the United States, is asking the Mexican government to keep them there. They're being passed across the border, but at a very slow rate for processing of these asylum claims. And that's causing more tensions. There was one point at which the Trump administration actually said that that Mexico should process Central Americans. There's a point at which they said that they should be willing to accept Central Americans in Mexico who were deported, and all that has caused considerable strain in the relationship.
Now, these the folks whose asylum applications have started to get processed in the United States. As far as you understand, what is their situation? Are they going to be held in a U.S. detention center while their applications are processed? These are primarily children and women, and we know the U.S. Under Trump has made it a point to separate mothers from children as a quote-unquote deterrent. So, you know, their fate, even if their application asylums are being processed, is in no way sort of guaranteed.
No, not at all. For one thing, a large number of asylum claims are denied, and that's becoming more and more the policy of the Trump administration. And for another thing, the use of relatively long-term detention is also one of the policies. And in part, they're doing it because they want to deter people from asking for asylum, knowing that they're going to have to spend time pretty much in jail as they wait for that process to begin to reach an outcome, which can take quite a long while. They're separating families. There's a law that says that children must be processed in 20 days, the Flores Agreement. They're trying to overturn that. They're trying to make the process even more difficult and even more drawn out for asylum seekers. In order to, again, keep them from attempting to be refugees in the United States. Now, what's tragic about that is that this is not just a case of people who want to go to the United States. When we talk about somebody who has an asylum claim and who is asking the government to file as a refugee, we're talking about somebody who is in a dire situation and a life and death situation. And this is the case with many of these people. I've talked to many at shelters throughout Mexico, and there have been a number of testimonies that have been taken with individuals on this caravan. Generally, oftentimes what's happened is that an organized crime group has, for whatever reason, targeted them, targeted someone in their family, made it extensive to the entire family, and said, we're going after you. And oftentimes they only have like a day or less to just pick up and leave before that threat can be carried out. So it's the idea that you could make asylum more difficult is really oftentimes a threat to send people back to situations where they could be killed.
So when we think about what poor Central Americans and poor Mexicans are facing when they try to escape both violence and poverty, is inhospitable governments in their own region, an inhospitable situation in government in the United States. It's a pretty scary prospect. I'm wondering if people are now attempting to cross the United States to go to Canada.
Well, the trip is so difficult,
Yeah.
and getting across the border, of course, is so difficult now too. That it's almost difficult to believe what people have to go through.
Yeah.
And that also gives you a sense of how dangerous the situation they're leaving is. They are robbed, they are attacked along the route in Mexico,
Women are raped.
yes, many, many women are raped, and yet they take this risk because they're leaving an absolutely untenable situation in their home country. So yes, you have entire populations that are coming into Mexico on a daily basis, seeking to get into the United States, although also we have a huge increase in asylum requests in Mexico as well, where people knowing that they are not welcome now in the United States, despite the fact that they have family there and that it would be a logical place for them to seek asylum, are now trying to just stay in Mexico, anywhere there where they can be safe and get their family to
Yeah.
safety, because a lot of people are also bringing young children out of situations
Right.
of danger. They have nowhere to go.
Yeah. There was a recent report in late April that estimated 7,000 bodies have been found in the US border with around the US border region with Mexico since the 1990s. That's the total count. It's a likely underestimate. It's a pretty dangerous border to cross, obviously. When we think about what's happening within Mexico as well, as far as you can tell, has the government, and I want to transition to talking about elections in Mexico in a minute, has the government under Peña Nieto, the current president of Mexico, pursued policies that have made it difficult for migrants or simply neglected to protect migrants from the violence they face?
Both things. In the first case, it's been evident because what's happened is that after the 2014 unaccompanied minors crisis hit the news in the United States, there was first a reaction of this is a humanitarian crisis, children who are coming up through dangerous conditions, out of dangerous conditions. But the upshot of that whole, that whole news cycle basically was that the restrictions became even tougher, both for kids, for families, and for migrants and refugees in general. And one of the things that happened is the United States, through the Merida Initiative, began to fund, with an initial funding of $70 million, the closing off of the Mexico-Guatemala border. So what they began to do is create a situation that's similar to a border security apparatus on the Mexico-United States border, on Mexico's southern border, to try to stop Central American migrants from coming into Mexico and thus eventually reaching the northern border with the United States. All that has criminalized migrants and refugees that are passing through Mexico. It means that they're easy prey for both organized crime, since they can't travel legally on buses and places where there's a certain modicum of protection. They're easy prey for organized crime, and they're also easy prey for corrupt security agents who shake them down, who beat them up, who basically have complete impunity to do what they want with this migrant population that has almost no recourse and no resources.
So, can you give us a sense of what the picture in Mexico is like politically right now, leading up to the July 1st elections? I understand Peña Nieto is termed out. Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who I mentioned earlier, is looking pretty good in the polls. Now, he had come close to winning an earlier election some years ago. This time around, could it be different?
It definitely could be different, and it's certainly looking like it will be. What's happening right now is that the polls are showing a wide lead for the center-left candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. It's up to like 20 points in some polls. As you know, there can be variation between different polls. And the other two leading candidates, José Antonio Meade of the Revolutionary Institutional Party of Peña Nieto, the ruling party currently, and Ricardo Anaya of the conservative PAN National Action Party are way behind. Anaya is slightly above Mead. Mead is looking like his candidacy is pretty much sunk already, although there's two more months until the elections. It's not rising as campaigns proceed. And so it looks like a fairly clear outcome at this point. But this, with the idea that this is a center-left candidate who does not have a radical platform, you know, is not a flaming populist, whatever that means.
Right. Some have said he's no Hugo Chavez.
No, and the word populist, you know, is used to disqualify people without anyone even really knowing what it means, including us political scientists. You know, there's no real definition, but there's been a lot of media that has been directly manipulated to attack him, and there's a lot of strong political interests and economic interests that are also attempting to see what can be done to bring down his candidacy. But with this wide a margin, he's in very good position, of course, as we go into the final stretch of the campaigns and of the elections. And what's happening is that there's talk of some of the other candidates, especially the independent candidates, stepping down to try to support the conservative candidacy. Margarita Zavala, who's the wife of former President Felipe Calderon, has a very small percentage in the polls and is being pressured to step down. This would have to happen in the next days, because soon the ballots will be printed up. And there's even been talk lately about somehow creating an alliance between the middle candidate, Ricardo Anaya of the Conservative Party, and the PRI, in order to reduce the field and present a stronger opposition to López Obrador. So this gives you a sense of how the powers that be are organizing themselves to try to prevent what looks like it would be a popular vote that would heavily favor López Obrador.
You have referred to him repeatedly as center-left. So specifically, what does López Obrador stand for in terms of, let's first talk about U.S.-Mexico relations. Now, Peña Nieto should have been a U.S.-friendly president because he's basically the kind of president that is most likely to be friendly with a U.S. president. But even, you know, with Trump in power, even a Peña Nieto-style president becomes an antagonistic figure with the United States. I don't imagine that's going to change very much under López Obrador. It might become worse.
Well, I think that the idea that the relationship between the United States and Mexico would become worse under López Obrador is probably mistaken, but it all depends on what your criteria are. Under Peña Nieto took everything that Trump dished out, basically. And he's been heavily criticized. His party's been punished in part for that, for not standing up to the kinds of insults and the tearing down of the relationship between two neighbors and trade partners that Trump has been doing since his campaign. There's a strong feeling among the Mexican people that Peña Nieto should have stood up to him more. And from the declarations that we've heard up till now from López Obrador, López Obrador is a candidate who would do that. López Obrador is not talking about a radical agenda with rupture between the United States and Mexico. Even on the NAFTA renegotiations, where typically the left has been very critical of the North American Free Trade Agreement, he's talking about having a better NAFTA and not completely pulling out of NAFTA or anything like that. And on other points too, he has called for a different security strategy and been quite clear in this. The war on drugs in Mexico has already cost nearly 200,000 lives and tens of thousands have disappeared. And there's almost a consensus now that something has to give in terms of that strategy, although other candidates have been much less explicit about what an alternative would look like and how they would actually break with the U.S. imposed war on drugs were they elected to the presidency. And of course, both those parties have been a big part of ramping up the war on drugs since it began in 2006. So as I say, we're not talking about a radical departure in U.S.-Mexico relations. And I think that it's certainly conceivable that a relationship in which Mexico stands up for its own national sovereignty and refuses to do the dirty work like we discussed of trapping Central American migrants in its own territory, on its own southern border, that is really part of an agenda, an anti-immigrant agenda of the Trump administration and of the United States government. If we had that, we could actually create a stronger and more workable relationship in which there could be policies that were much more mutually beneficial for both the peoples of both countries.
Well, Laura, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll certainly try to have you back on our program on the eve of the July 1st election. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Laura Carlson is director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy and a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. Based in Mexico City, we've been discussing both the caravan that just arrived in Tijuana as well as Mexico's upcoming election. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.